Hello and welcome to your Community Radio News Desk. I'm Adrienne Murphy, and coming up on today's programme, Lindy Taylor tells Donie Tarrant how her local community radio station helped her trace her great aunt. And a week on from Davos, Darren J. Pryor talks to Michael McCarthy Flynn from Oxfam about world poverty. But first, Brendan O'Sconnell from Connemara FM spoke to Helen Donoghue, Chair of the Access Conservation Committee with Mountaineering Ireland, about the right of way and the bill to protect landowners from claims by hill walkers, which is being discussed in Dáileann at the moment.
Well, we're an organisation which represents the interests of about 12,000 hill walkers and climbers across the island of Ireland. The sort of things in which we would be representing hill walkers would be exactly one of the issues we're talking about tonight, the access, continued access to our wonderful countryside for walking and climbing, the conservation of the mountains to ensure that they, if you like, improve in quality over time rather than diminish the quality of the experience which we all have. Mountaineering Ireland also organises the sport aspects of hill walking and climbing, perhaps more developed in the climbing side than in the hill walking side. So there's about 12,000 of us. Of course, there are many other people who are out just on Sunday walks around the country. Not all of them are members of Mountaineering Ireland. It's mainly club members who are in Mountaineering Ireland.
And of course, as you say, part of your job is to try and support the access for people to get walking and to go into the mountains. So that's very much part of this particular bill. Tell me a little bit about the background to the bill itself. I mean, it's been on the go for quite a long time, this particular one.
Yes. Well, the bigger picture is the need in Ireland to organise access on the basis of permissive access. Other countries and our neighbouring countries have different arrangements. Their legislatures have chosen to either give people rights, or like a right to roam in Scotland or in the UK. There are responsibilities on local authorities and powers to designate areas as open access areas. In Ireland, so far, now, despite a couple of bills put forward in 2008 and 2013, but so far, the Oireachtas has not chosen to organise access to the Irish countryside any other way than by relying on permissive access. Now, that means voluntary agreement by informal, indeed, voluntary agreement by landowners to let the people of Ireland walk across their lands and get to climbing crags there, etc., for, if you like, the pure benefit of outdoor recreation. Now, it is recognised by all sides that this system has to be made to work. So as early as 2004, then Minister O'Quive set up an organisation called Cor Lena Tuatha, which still exists, we're still meeting, and in that organisation, the farming organisations and recreational interests and then state interests, say Quilche among the landowners, we're all meeting together to make sure that we can set up some sort of a reasonable framework which can be used throughout the country so as to achieve practical access and, you know, to the glorious countryside that we all want to use, both us and the tourists. Now, the main framework that has been developed, it was proposed as early as 2009, and is the one framework which we are all working to establish on some reasonable basis. It's called Mountain Access Areas, Mountain Access by Agreement. And in this arrangement, we have the voluntary agreement by all the landowners in defined areas. Now, at the moment, it's been trialled in the McGillicuddy Reeks and in Benlevy. So we have a defined area. All the landowners agree to allow access. Now, from the point of view of the recreational users, what do we bring to the table? First of all, a clear acceptance of responsibility on our part that we're going to protect the lands of the landowners. We're going to look after our own safety, not leave waste, and you know, you can the normal responsibility that we would expect of users. In addition, there's agreement on all the practical things which need to be sorted out. Exactly which access points? How do you get to those access points? Where are you going to park? Styles so that nobody will be knocking down fences. Any necessary signage? And perhaps most crucially, a management forum to sort out any problems, stop issues becoming problems. Now, that's the overall picture. And the one element which has been promised by the government in that picture, they would contribute an indemnification scheme in that, which would mean that landowners would, if there were any claim by a recreational user against a landowner, the state claims agency would step in and the landowner would not have to be bothered. Now, if I can just point one thing out, though, you know, in this balance of contributions from all the players, landowners are not responsible for any accident that a recreational user would have. If I twist and fall and break my arm, I'm not going to sue the landowner. The landowner's responsibilities under the Occupiers' Liability Act are only to act, to not intentionally harm, damage either myself or my property, and not to act with reckless disregard for recreational users. Honestly, our landowners in Ireland are most unlikely to be doing that, and indeed there has been no claim, to the best of my knowledge, under the Occupiers Liability Act against a farmer so far. But nevertheless, Mountaineering Ireland supports the idea that the farmers would be in no doubt that if there were a claim under the Occupiers Liability Act against them, the state claims agency would step in. Why? Because we have to make permissive access work. It would be madness to have a situation in a beautiful country like Ireland in which the people of Ireland and the tourists wouldn't be able, in practical terms, to enjoy the countryside. We're not talking of people's fields. We're talking of the unfenced uplands, which are clearly open. We're just talking about making it predictable for everybody, under what conditions access can be allowed.
Okay. Now, obviously, Mountaineering Ireland has put a lot of work into this, and I know meeting with the minister, Minister Ring. But do you find, we say, reaction from the IFA, from farming organisations, and maybe even from just local groups? Are there still kind of disagreements with people, or are people now beginning to sing off the same hymn sheet?
Well, and the disagreements, of course, as in all areas of life, disagreements are very local, and very often it will turn out to be the practical issues, like, say, parking, leaving gates open, dogs. We would certainly, not be for allowing dogs on lands with sheep. So they're very practical things. This is why, as part of the overall arrangement, we think it's very important that there should be a local management forum to sort out and deal with problems. And that management forum would have somebody, if you like, on the landowner side and somebody on the recreational interest side, whether it's walking or climbing or canoeing or what have you. Now, so far, in the two areas in which it has been piloted, you perhaps have been reading the request from the people in the McGillicuddy Reeks Forum to have a good idea about who's planning to come to their intensively used area. This actually seems reasonable to many of the players. So my point is really that it's on the ground locally that problems are recognised and that solutions are developed. What we're trying to sort out at, if you like, national level is a framework that can be used at local level. The farming organisations are fully participating in Corla na Tuaithe, and they have committed themselves to making this sort of mountain access by agreement actually work on the ground. So we would certainly expect them to follow through on that commitment. As I say, in practice, on the ground, solutions are normally being sorted out locally.
Okay. Now, the minister, they're saying that the scheme should be introduced before the end of the year. So are they still kind of working then on this project, and hopefully, as I say, we'll have it organised?
Well, that is certainly our understanding. The latest report which we had from the people dealing with Corla Natuha suggested that. Now, of course, it does involve the Attorney General's Office and the State Claims Agency. To be honest, we would certainly not understand why it would take an awful lot more time, especially since the Teresa Wall case, which was perhaps a very particular case, this was in 2017, the High Court has been clear in the expectations from recreational users walking on private land. So if you like, the interpretation of the Occupiers Liability Act has become very much clearer since the Teresa Wall case, and therefore you would think that the budgeting for, if there's any, for the indemnification scheme would have already become quite clear.
Our thanks to Connemara FM for that piece. And if you would like more information on Mountaineering Ireland, you can contact them on 01 625 1115, or you can email info@mountaineering.ie. Now, as all of you who regularly listen to your local community radio station will know, the ethos of community radio is very much about the community, by the community, and for the community. This was illustrated earlier when Lindy Taylor spoke to Donie Tarrant and explained how a chance visit to a history talk hosted by Near FM at her local library led to her tracing her great aunt.
Yeah, it started, I'd say, about 2014 when I was researching some family history with my local history group, Rohini Heritage Society. And we were doing genealogy, and I had accidentally found a younger sister, my grandfather's younger sister, Hannah Taylor, who I had never heard of before. I pursued it with my aunt, who's quite elderly, and I asked her who was Hannah Taylor, and she informed me that Hannah died during World War One. Shock. I had no idea that we had a family member even involved in World War One. It was a fascinating kind of little nugget in our family history, so I decided to do it further. The information I could get from my aunt was that she became a nun and she was nursing at the Somme, originally is what she said, and that she was killed in a gas attack. So armed with this information, I had rung around all my local, she was from Cork City, so I rang around all the local nunneries in Cork to see if they had any records of this Hannah Taylor. Further information then I got from my aunt was that she had actually gone to France and joined a French order of nuns, but she didn't know who. This is what the major problem was, that without an order, without her nun's name, I found it very, very difficult to trace. So I had checked all the newspapers in Cork for any mention of her. I checked all the convents that I could. I wrote to the Diocese of Amiens. I wrote to the Vatican even at one point. And this was going on, Donnie, for nearly four years before I kind of got it together. And the only reason I actually got it together was because my aunt sent me a photograph. And there was a photograph of this nun in her nun's attire. Still didn't know the order, still didn't know what convent. And the local radio station, you guys, Near FM, were doing a series of shows on World War One. So I thought, great, I might go along just with my photo and see if anybody at that would have any idea of what was going. So I went up to the library, the local library, and I ended up chatting with one of the speakers, a lady called Jennifer Wellington, who's a professor in UCD specializing in women's history. Showed her the photograph, and from that, she took a photograph of it, and she passed it on to a colleague of hers, Professor John McCafferty, who's an expert in clerical attire. He shared the photograph, and we got a definitive answer from London to say the nun in the photograph was from the congregation of Bon Secours de Paris. So from that, I could contact the Bon Secours in Paris. And there she was, all her records, Grand Aunt Hannah. She was joined in the 24th of May, 1915. She took the name Sister Saint Alexandra, and she died on the 29th of January, 1916, and is buried in their convent at a place called Rosay-en-Brie. She died from respiratory failure as a result of the gas attack, and she was only 22 years old. But I would never have found that information if I hadn't gone up to the library for that talk by Near FM on World War One. It was the breakthrough I needed, if you like. I would never have got there otherwise. And I have to be honest, it actually reduced me to tears when I actually found that she did exist, you know, that it wasn't a figment of my imagination. It wasn't a figment of my answer. But this story was true. Quite often, we get a lot of stories from our parents and grandparents that tend to be embellished a bit. We're Irish. We don't let the truth get in the way of a good story. But to actually find out that this was true, I had a grandaunt who died in World War One. She was a Roman Catholic nun, and I would never have found her if it hadn't been for that photograph and the help I got from you guys, from Jennifer and from Professor McCafferty. She would never have been. I'd never have got her.
It's a fascinating story, Lindy, and I mean, I wonder, and it's a very, very unfair question probably to ask you, but I just wonder how many more people in this country are in the same position where relatives that maybe they didn't even know they had went off to World War One, never again to be heard or seen of, and maybe because of the historical context of the time, never spoken about because they were involved in World War One.
Well, that's the problem. I would say I am not unique on this. I'd say there are hundreds, maybe thousands of people who have a relative. It's a period of our history that we didn't really and don't still talk about. We don't talk about that period between 1916 and 1922, really. It just, we fluffed over because it's too hard to deal with. It's a very traumatic, you know, in that space of time, we had three wars. We had the First World War, we had the War of Independence, and then we had a Civil War straight afterwards. So it was a very difficult period in our history. So I think a lot of that period got not spoken about. We don't speak about it. It got buried. And there's all these lovely little gems of individuals that did different bits or their own bits that just seem to have been kind of brushed under the carpet.
And Lindy, there's a massive Cork connection here now. I mean, was it that she was raised in Cork, she lived in Cork, or that she moved to Cork, or was it that the family came from Cork to Dublin? What's the link to Cork?
Yeah, no one came to Dublin at all. My dad was the only person of his family that came to Dublin. They were all from Cork. Originally, her father, John Taylor, he was a carpenter. Actually, from Villiers down in Waterford. And I've actually traced back in Waterford, in Villiers town, 1792. They were all carpenters. But at one point, my great-grandfather would have had to go to England for work during the Victorian period. So he was shipbuilding in England. So my grandfather, John Edward Taylor, was actually born in Liverpool, as was his younger sister. But when the family moved back, they moved back to Cork because my great-grandmother was from Cork. She was a lady called Mary Baker, and her father, Thomas Baker, was a cooper in Cork as well. So that side of the family were all from Cork. So they moved back into Blarney Street. And my granddad, I think, had a workshop there as a carpenter in Blarney Street. So all the family were from Blarney Street. So Hannah, being the youngest, was actually born in Cork City. So she was from Cork. And they stayed in Blarney Street. And it's funny because my father, his younger brother, the next one down, Uncle Tom, he had a shirt manufacturing business in Blarney Street because my grandfather had opened a shirt manufacturer's and then my Uncle Tom took it over. So there was still the business in Blarney Street right up until the 2000s. It eventually got sold, I think, in 2002.
And
so we've been based in Cork forever.
Lindy, before we close out on it, okay, you're the, we'll say, the second generation away from her because she would have been your grand-aunt. But would there have been any of the older generation still living? Probably not, we'll say, her nieces or nephews that would be
able to... my aunt. My aunt is the only one left of that generation. She would have been my father's sister. So my grandfather's daughter, so it would have been her niece, if you like. So she is the only one. She's going to be nearly 90, my Auntie Moore, and she's living in the family home. We had my grandfather had a big house on Old Yall Road, very posh. So my aunt still lives in that house on Old Yall Road, but she'd be the only person left.
And that was Lindy Taylor there. And thanks to Joni Tarrant for that piece. Now, finally, as world leaders and the world's wealthiest elite met in Davos last week, Darren J. Pryor spoke to Michael McCarthy Flynn, the Senior Research and Policy Coordinator with Oxfam, to reflect on the growing divide between rich and poor. Darren began by asking Michael to reflect on the growing number of billionaires in the world.
Okay, well, the World Economic Forum takes place in Davos every year around this time in January, and it's a global gathering of the great and good around the world, basically the political and financial elites. And they get together to look at trends in the world and decide a lot of policies that will affect the rest of us. And Oxfam has been saying for the last 5 years that the global inequality crisis, where last year, billionaires' wealth went up by $2.5 billion a day, while the poorest half of humanity, that's 3.8 billion people, their wealth declined by $500 million a day, is the biggest challenge facing humanity at the moment, and it has to be taken seriously. And that's really why, I guess, we're in the news. You see a big event where people are smoozing, people are making decisions. Usually they're billionaires or they're world leaders who would be listening to the ear of billionaires, but not listening to the majority of humanity who aren't benefiting from economic and social policies. So we hold up a mirror to what's going on in Davos and saying things need to change.
Am I right in saying that Oxfam are not an anti-capitalist organisation, but you believe that the way the current financial system works is not fair?
Well, no, Oxfam isn't anti-wealth, we're anti-poverty. And there has been huge achievements in reducing poverty in the last few decades. Extreme poverty has been halved in the last 15 to 20 years. However, major institutions like the World Bank have pointed out that the extreme inequality that the world is experiencing at the moment is going to block our attempts to get rid of extreme inequality altogether. I can give you an example from Zambia. Zambia is one of the fastest growing economies in Africa. Between 1998 and 2010, its economy grew by 6%. Yet during this period, 4 million people fell into poverty. So as you said, it's the type of growth we see, the type of economic decisions isn't pro-poor, and it isn't inclusive. What we're calling for is inclusive and sustainable growth that doesn't just benefit those at the top, but prioritising lifting people out of poverty.
I believe in your report that you launched a few days ago, you said that the poorest half of the people in the world saw their wealth decrease by 11%. Is that, I assume, the effect of, we hear about in the media in Ireland, over the last year, there's been a slowdown in emerging markets, to use that term. Is that what that is, kind of like?
It's hard to pinpoint exactly why it is. That may be one factor, but probably the biggest factor, as I pointed out with the example of Zambia, that the global economy is still growing, and emerging economies and poor economies in total are still growing. It's where that extra economic benefit is going to. And it's going more to people at the top than people in the bottom. So that's why we would estimate that fall in wealth has happened.
Okay, and I only saw it today, there was a big article in the Irish Times yesterday about Oxfam in India, wasn't there?
Yes, well, you know, Oxfam works in over 90 countries. We not just bring out a big global report, but a number of countries, especially the big countries like India and Brazil, have done really in-depth analysis about their countries. And the global trends are replicated in these countries. Like India has had massive amount of growth in the last few decades. Their economy has come on really strong. But like what we're saying in Zambia, what we're saying around the world, it hasn't benefited everybody. So the top 10% in India control 75, 76% of the wealth. So, you know, little over 20% of the wealth in India is left for the other 90%. And that's hugely challenging for the people at the bottom who aren't being lifted out of poverty because of this massive growth.
I saw some tweets on Twitter yesterday by US economist Jesse Colombo, and he was saying that over the last 10 years, the increase in wealth amongst people who are wealthy in the Western and in the world in general, it's an increase in their value of their assets. Like it's not actually a cash increase in their wealth. Do you know anything about that?
Well, there's a number of ways that people's wealth increase, and it is true that some degree of wealth increase is due to assets like housing property, and it might be a cash asset, but it can be transferred into a cash asset. But when we're looking at the 1% or even the top 10 of the 1%, most of their extreme increases, when we're talking about billionaires who have hundreds of billions of dollars, most of that is through financial assets, through shares, through currency holdings, through stocks, etc. And they can easily be transferred into cash.
There's a US Democratic Party Congresswoman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I believe her name is, and she's been getting a lot of publicity in the last few months saying that wealthy people in the US should pay a lot more tax. Did you know much or support her work much?
Well, I think she's opened up a very important debate in the US, that we know that the top rate of personal income tax in rich countries fell from 62% in 1970 to just 38% a few years ago. When America really tackled inequality before, after the Depression, they agreed that to really deal with this problem, that wealthy people had to pay their fair share, and that meant paying a higher level of tax, similar to what the Congresswoman is asking for. So the exact dynamics of it, you know, would need to be worked out, but certainly we would be saying that rich people need to pay their fair share of tax, and we don't believe that they are at the moment.
Okay, Michael, from an Irish government point of view, what changes do you believe that they should make?
Well, for the main way that Ireland interfaces with this problem is through our corporate tax policy. While our corporate tax policy has been very beneficial domestically in creating jobs and facilitating investment, there's sort of a parallel side to that people are probably aware of since the Apple judgment, where money flows through our accounts from other countries and also from poorer countries that has little economic benefit to Ireland, but facilitates those companies to avoid large amounts of tax. This is hugely negative for poorer countries because their ability to provide public services to help poor people lift themselves out of poverty is dependent on being able to generate revenue from economic activity, including the profits of corporations. So we would call on the Irish government, although they have made a good start in trying to tackle this problem, there really needs to be a fundamental reform of the corporate tax system. And that reform needs to have the voices of the poorest country in discussions, because they're going to be most impacted by that. There's hopefully going to be a new round of reforms starting for discussion at the OECD level. I know France, even today, has been calling for a global minimum effective tax rate. So they're the type of things that we need to look at seriously, and that Ireland has to really start thinking about supporting rather than being a blocker.
And that was Michael McCarthy Flynn, Senior Research and Policy Coordinator with Oxfam there. If you want more information on Oxfam, you can contact them at info@oxfam.org, or you can phone them on 01 672 7662.